You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Welcome to the DMZ. We are without Matt Lewis for the second week, so send your hate mail to Matt K. Lewis at dmcshow.com. My email address doesn't really exist. It's unfortunate because Matt made some news this week when he took a pot shot at Jimmy Kimmel around this around his comments about his newborn child and healthcare. But if you've been tuning into CNN, you've seen that back and forth. But we have a special treat. We have a fellow bloggingheads.tv star from the show Rational Actors, Kevin Glass. Great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me, Bill, and very honored to be sitting in the esteemed seat of Matt Lewis, at least for just 1 week. Matt and I go back a long way. We worked together at Town Hall like 10 years ago. So love his work. I've always followed it. Love the DMZ. Happy to be here. Like you said, I'm also a host of a Blogging Heads show called Rational Actors. You can find that on the site, obviously. I've had a couple things come up, so I haven't recorded one of those in a while. I will get right on it, I promise you, producers. But you can also find my work kind of around the web. I'm a regular contributor to the Washington Examiner, and I just had a piece up on The Hill yesterday. So you can check those out and follow me on Twitter at Kevin W. Glass.
So for those who haven't watched Rational Actors or listened to the podcast version, what is the focus of that show?
Well, I try to bring on people who have more expert opinions than I do on the various topics of the day. So if we're talking healthcare, someone who writes exclusively about healthcare, if we're talking technology policy, someone who writes about that. So, I try to play the part of inquisitor and talk to people who are smarter than me.
So related to that, I guess, you're coming from the right, of course. Where on the right do you situate yourself? Are you never Trump right? Are you a reformocon? Are you fully on the Trump train and everyone should, you know, shut up and salute?
Everyone who has followed me knows I am firmly never Trump. I voted for Hillary Clinton in the general election, so I'm even that hard.
Wow.
Of never
you're not,
Trump.
You're not even McMillan.
No, I'm not even McMullen. I talked to Ben Howe on Rational Actors a couple months ago. He was never Trump and was planning on voting on Hillary Clinton until McMullen kind of became an option as a conservative protest vote. Most people who voted for McMullen are unhappy with his performance on the communication side post-election, as he's been quite the kind of moralizing hectorer all over the place. But yeah, so I was someone who followed through on the voting for Clinton over Trump bandwagon, but someone who still has supports and respects many members of Congress who are Republicans, who I did, you know, before the Trump era as well. So that'll actually be something interesting with some of what they've been doing over the last couple of weeks and some of the, I would say, issues that I have with their tactics so far.
So we weren't planning to talk about this, but I'm quite fascinated now. So almost everyone I know on the right who was either anti-Trump or skeptical of Trump, except for like for a few national security types, generally could not get past the 20-year narrative of Hillary in conservative circles as a corrupt demon. Which a narrative which I feel like it still lingers in the minds of many. Having crossed that Rubicon at least once, how does that is there a lasting impact of doing that, or did it feel to you like this is just a isolated situation? I'm still a Republican. I'm still a conservative, and I will go forth from that basis.
So the kind of Trumpification of the Republican Party is bad. I have considered unregistering as a Republican, but that kind of is more of a tactical, this would be more of a tactical decision because I live in Washington, D.C., and therefore voting for Republicans and voting in like DC Republican primaries is largely useless. The vote for the mayor of DC, the real vote is the Democratic primary when you're voting for mayor of DC, and I can't vote for that as a Republican. So it would be partially protest, partially tactical if I did deregister as a Republican. But yes, I'm still a Republican, I'm still a conservative. I'm someone who didn't vote for Mitt Romney because I didn't think he was conservative enough, for example. I cast a protest vote in that election. But look, I look at 2016 as I'm not someone who says there are only two choices and you have to choose between them. But at the same time, the value of a protest vote has to be larger than the gulf between the two parties. And in this case, I did not think that that was the case, that Hillary Clinton was much safer choice for president than the value of voting for McMullen or for Gary Johnson or whoever else your favorite protest candidate might have been.
Well, beyond just party registration, my sense is that, or I was curious whether once you saw how dishonest Trump was, and you're seeing dishonest smears of Hillary Clinton in action, not being part of that team, being able to see it from a more of a detached vantage point. I mean, I sort of saw this with Charlie Sykes, who was a conservative Wisconsin radio host,
Yeah, he's great. Love Charlie.
who was, and I had a chance to interview him for a piece that didn't get published because the election ruined those plans. But he was beginning to work through maybe some of the things that we had been saying as conservatives in the past really didn't hold up to scrutiny. Not talking about policy prescriptions per se, but the attacks on Hillary that were really over the top. Being able to take a step back and say, wait a second, maybe we unleashed a monster here that we end up not being able to contain. So, do you see yourself in that camp where you feel like the way conservatism has been waged politically, does that leave a bad taste in your mouth now, having seen it from someone who actually fully broke ranks last year?
No. I think Trump is a remarkably dishonest politician. I don't know if he is like two standard deviations more dishonest than the average dishonest politician. So, I don't think that that's particularly a reason to distance myself from the Republican Party. I'm someone who thinks most of the attacks lobbed against Hillary Clinton were accurate. Most of how horrible that Republicans said that Hillary Clinton was as a candidate were accurate. And that says a lot about how horrible Donald Trump was as a candidate, that it was still an easy choice to vote for her.
Fair enough. We're recording on Thursday noon. It is before the House votes on the latest incarnation of the American Healthcare Act. I think the assumption is that it will pass today. We
The
could
House.
the House.
Yes.
I think the assumption is going to pass the House, and probably DOA in the Senate. So forgive us if this presumption proves wrong and something unexpected happens on the floor today. But they're holding this vote with a fairly not a wholesale overhaul of what was rejected before. They have a waiver now on the stipulation that you can't deny coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. A state can apply for a waiver. If they get that waiver, they then have to do a high-risk pool to cover those folks. And general consensus seems to be, so they got a few extra votes by adding $8 billion to that pool. But I've seen studies on both the left and the right saying this is underfunded by, almost $200 billion. So $8 billion really doesn't get you very far. And therefore, the Medicaid cuts, the rejection of the individual mandate, how that would affect premiums, all that stuff, is still seems to be untenable for at minimum the Democrats who can filibuster in the Senate. Oh, excuse me, but will be reconciliation, right? So that the filibuster is not a factor there, correct?
We'll see. Well, so that part is going to get complicated. There are people who think that the waiver provision that states can opt out of the EHB coverage might not pass reconciliation. So, you know, that's something that, you know, there's a whole lot that rides on that, and I'm not sure that anyone knows. So, for example, they're going to bring this to the House floor because, well, we think because they have the votes, right? You shouldn't bring legislation to a vote if you don't have the votes, especially if you're the majority party. I'm not sure that that applies because it seemed like the Trump White House wanted to bring something to the floor last time around that didn't have the votes just to get people's names on the record. But I'm pretty sure they have the votes this time. Once it moves to the Senate, I'm not sure the extent to which Senate leadership can go to the parliamentarian before it actually comes up and say, are you going to approve this, right? They might have to, and the parliamentarian's office in general in the past has been pretty good about keeping a wall and saying, I'm not going to tell you what's going to pass and what's not going to pass my judgment on reconciliation. So I'm not sure that the waiver provision is going to come in under muster for reconciliation. Beyond that, I'm not sure that the moderate Republicans, and I say moderate as in less freedom caucus-y Republicans in the Senate, are going to be on board with this. It's something that goes against a lot of what Republicans had said for years on reforming the healthcare system. Basically, that the House is going to vote on this without having a CBO score. They're rushing it through pretty quickly, when one of the hugest arguments they used over and over and over again against the Affordable Care Act was, you didn't give us enough time to really consider this, when, like, the legislative process took basically a whole year to get through. And this is, we're 3 months into the Trump administration. We're like a week into seeing the new AHCA language. We don't have a CBO score. So, you know, I expect that they're going to pass it in the House, but beyond that, I really have no idea. I've talked to people on Capitol Hill on the Dem side who think that Dems wouldn't even filibuster even if they needed to, because they are so convinced that this would be such an electoral disaster for Republicans that Democrats would just win such enormous majorities in 2018 and 2020 that they could do whatever they wanted again on health care.
So I've seen a couple people, a couple reporters on Twitter liken this to the 2009 cap and trade vote, which did pass the House, even with a handful of Republicans voting for it. That's largely forgotten. Not very many, but a few.
than voted for the ACA.
That's right. And the margin of difference, if I remember correctly, because a handful of Democrats were against it. But never saw the light of day in the Senate. Didn't go to a committee, didn't go to the floor. You know, there was a separate attempt by John Kerry and Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman to come up with an alternative bill, which they just about accomplished, and the BP spill happened, which made environmentalist demands go up and made the oil companies pull out, and that deal unraveled. My point is, I mean, McConnell's got, I guess, three options here. He could rush it to the floor. He could send it to committee so they get changed if it got out of committee at all, or it could just languish. It could just not come up at all. Are there going odds within Washington which of those paths he's going to take?
I can't say there are going odds on that. What I suspect is the expectation that it'll die in the Senate will actually get more Republicans in the House to vote on it. Just like passing the Obamacare repeals when President Obama was president, right? They all voted for the same thing over and over and over again because they knew it was going to be vetoed. When you actually expect your legislation to go into effect, you're going to be a lot more careful. So I suspect that this is just a kind of way to say that the House all got on board, Trump's on board, and it's just too bad that we couldn't get past the archaic rules of the Senate to do anything meaningful on it. Or they might scapegoat the centrist Republicans in the Senate. So I'm not sure on what the odds are on McConnell's options. I really think, the parliamentarian issue looms over all of that beforehand, because obviously if they don't need 60 votes, then that opens up all of McConnell's options. If they do need 60 votes, well, then that's just the end of it. The Democrats are probably going to filibuster it.
Yeah, I your point about it not probably not becoming law is interesting because there's a lot of talk on the left that this vote's going to be a midterm issue for vulnerable House Republicans, and they're signing their death warrants by voting for it. But if it does not become law, I mean, I would think it's more electorally dangerous if it becomes law. If you people actively lose their health care before Election Day 2018, you hang that on their heads. If it's all theoretical, then it seems less potent to me.
Well, so the one of the big things is I'm pretty sure, and maybe you can correct me, but the Medicaid pullback on coverage wouldn't take effect until 2020. So you wouldn't see tons of people losing Medicaid coverage, which is the lion's share of people who gained coverage under Obamacare. So that might not be that potent of an electoral issue. I'm certain that in 2018, no matter what happens with the vote, you'll see ads from the Democratic side saying, Congressman X voted to take away insurance from Y number of people according to the CBO, and you would see
20
ads
24
about
million
that.
unless the new score is worse.
You'll see, Republican congressman from this district voted to take away, according to the CBO, 24 million people's health insurance. Even if that doesn't become law, that's probably a campaign ad. Obviously, the Republicans who would vote for this don't see that being a particularly harmful issue for them because they're going to vote for it anyway. So I'm not sure. It could be that Democrats would love it as a campaign issue, so they're thrilled. The Republicans keep pushing this kind of in a haphazard manner, but that's going to be something that it's not going to happen for a couple more years.
Forgive me if I'm asking you something that gets too deep in the budget weeds. My understanding is that the process that Ryan and McConnell laid out was to do budget reconciliation for healthcare. And for those who aren't too steeped in, budget reconciliation is a parliamentary process that allows you to circumvent filibusters in the Senate. If it does not add to the deficit. The idea was there was a deficit reduction provision. And there are a lot of rules around how you can do that. You can only do it once per fiscal year, and you have to pass a budget resolution that includes budget reconciliation instructions, which they have done for 2017. They say in the instructions you can do health care for your related budget reconciliation bill. They also want to do budget reconciliation for tax reform, but that would be for fiscal year 2018. They thought they can't bundle the two things into one ginormous 2017 bill. So when you keep hearing Donald Trump say we got to do health care first, not being a parliamentary expert, he doesn't mention the obstacle course that Ryan and McConnell created in the 2017 budget resolution. So if this passes today, which we assume, you now have a question whether this is reconciliation friendly or not, based on what you've just told me. At minimum, I would think, and maybe you know better, so long as they're going around in circles on healthcare and they're not actually completing it, you are delaying your ability to pursue tax reform unless you jump ahead to fiscal year 2018. And if you do, you then negate your ability to use your 2017 instructions for healthcare at all. So to what extent it does them refusing to quit healthcare complicate their ability to do tax reform?
It complicates it a lot. That's one of the reasons I think that this is all a smokescreen, and the House Republicans just want to get a vote out and say, we did it. We did the health care. We gave it our best. We passed what we said we were going to pass. It died in the Senate. Whether that is the parliamentarian says you can't do this, or the Democrats filibuster it, right? So I, again, that's another reason why I suspect that it's not going to, it's just going to die in the Senate, and that this is just kind of a show vote.
But it has, like, to, has to not just die, it has to die and then say we're done here.
Right,
if
right.
They're going to move to tax reform.
Right. I think the message that Republicans can tell themselves in the House is, listen, the first push on the American Health Care Act was way too quick. Nobody was on board. You know, the legislation came out. None of the establishment think tanks liked it. No, basically nobody liked it. That was a mistake. The second time, we got all our ducks in a row. We altered the legislation to get the Freedom Caucus on board. We did our part. We tried really hard, and we're going to come back to this later, but obviously we need to move on to something that's more pressing, tax reform, something that we is easier to get all the Republicans on the same side on, tax reform.
Is it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. The, I mean, the establishment Republican infrastructure in D.C. Is an A-plus on reforming taxes. They know what they're doing. On healthcare, they don't. And it's been clear for a very long time that they don't know what they're doing. And even before Obamacare went into effect, Republican plans were kind of sloppy and haphazard. Then trying to pull off the infrastructure that Obamacare put in place and then putting your own plan in place complicates it even more. And Republicans really haven't had a plan of doing that, even though they've said they have. They have straight Obamacare repeal, right? And they have replace bills, but we're not entirely sure how those would interact. But the ideal situation for both of those is that they need 60 votes, and they're trying to do something without 60 votes, which kind of gets them into this really weird spider's web of policy mechanisms that don't interact all that well and rely a lot on things like the HHS having to grant waivers to the states to get out of some of the ACA regulations. Tax reform is much easier for Republicans to do. They have experts who have been working in these fields and a lot more of them for a much longer time. So I do expect that to go smoother, even if it's not going to be entirely smooth. And it's a lot easier to do all the things that they want to do on tax reform through reconciliation. There aren't these kind of parliamentarian questions with reconciliation because obviously tax reform is a primarily budgetary matter.
Although it has to be revenue neutral, which that's the part that's getting them most hung up.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't have to be for reconciliation. It doesn't have to be revenue neutral.
Well, it could cut the deficit, which cutting taxes doesn't do.
It can also increase the deficit if you so. You could pass an enormous increase in subsidies for the ACA or peel back of subsidies for the ACA, and that's the only thing you do. That would pass reconciliation because what reconciliation says is that it just has to be primarily budgetary in effect. It doesn't say whether it has to be neutral or not, just that it is primarily a budgetary issue. So tax reform, you can do something that increases or decreases the deficit. Now, Republicans have said for a long time, well, some Republicans have said for a long time, that they want their tax reform plans to be budget neutral, and they're going to try as hard as they can to get them to be budget neutral. And most of them also say that the way that they consider budget neutrality is through dynamic scoring, which is not what the CBO is going to say. But they can say they can pass something that the CBO says increases the deficit as long as the primary effect is budgetary, which for tax reform, it is probably going to be. It's going to be a much smoother sail through the parliamentarian and through the reconciliation process.
Now, I've also read in a couple places that, and it's been sort of buried in larger pieces about the state of play, that there are Republicans that are concerned that they won't be able to pass a fiscal year 2018 budget resolution. And if you can't pass the resolution, you can't do a related budget reconciliation bill, which was the plan for tax reform. And some folks then said, well, maybe that we should go rewrite the 2017 instructions and do tax reform right there instead of healthcare. Healthcare is not going to go anywhere. Have you heard anything along these lines?
Well, it turns out that governing is harder than they might have previously thought. And honestly, I think Mitch McConnell knows what he's doing when it comes to some of the actual kind of rules of legislating. I'm not sure that Paul Ryan has that skill set. Maybe he's still learning. I think he's a smart guy. I like Paul Ryan, and I hope that he'll understand what he needs to do when it comes to some of these rules. But it's also clear that most of the House Republican caucus, not just the Freedom Caucus, just House Republicans who have not been in power for 12 years now, aren't familiar with a lot of the rules that they need to go through. And specifically because the reconciliation rules are Senate specific. So it's not like House legislators have needed to know some of those rules for a very long time. But because most of the legislating they want to get done has to go through the reconciliation process, because a lot of Senate Democrats are just saying, we're going to filibuster everything no matter what, they need to kind of get up to speed on what those rules are and how they can use them. So, and, you know, that includes Speaker Paul Ryan. You know, he's not an expert in Senate procedure, but the things that they pass out of the House have to be reconciliation eligible because of kind of the way that the Senate is going to work for the foreseeable future. So I'm not sure if they're going to be able to pass that 2018 budget resolution, because, you know, budget resolutions, the Republicans have kind of made out in the past, staked out the position that budget resolutions are moral documents. And even though they passed one already for 2017 that funded Planned Parenthood, which they said they were against, it funded Obamacare, which they said they were against.
Resolutions are not law.
They're
not signed by the president. They're guidelines to that help you with the rest of the budgeting process.
But we had a government shutdown because Ted Cruz and the Freedom Caucus convinced each other and themselves that, you know, passing a budget resolution that continued to fund things that they didn't want to fund was in effect passing something that funded those things.
But the shutdown happens when you get to the appropriations process, which is what's supposed to follow the budget resolution process.
Right. Oh yeah. Yes. So yeah. So we'll see if they can get their ducks in a row on the 2018 issues. I think and I hope that they're learning and they'll be better on it in the future, but we'll see. I honestly don't know.
I could talk congressional budgets with you all day, Kevin, as I'm sure our listeners want us to do. But let's shift to the other big news of the day, which is the executive order, which I'm actually not sure what it's supposed to really accomplish. It's being talked about as a loosening of what churches can do in regards to political activity without losing their tax-exempt status. I haven't read the actual wording of it. It obviously can't change the law about your tax-exempt status and what political activity you're allowed to undertake. I am guessing it's sort of a directive that says to the IRS, hey, don't leave these guys alone if they start getting active. But you might know more than me. Do you think this, and I've also read this is not as expansive an order as what was initially being bandied about earlier in the year that Pence was pushing and that apparently Ivanka and Jared helped scuttle. Is this significant enough for Trump to maintain the surprising loyalty he has earned from social conservatives? Or is this, a lot of social conservatives are disappointed with the Republican presidents. They don't go to the mat for them. You don't end up defunding Planned Parenthood. You don't end up overturning Roe v. Wade at the Supreme Court level. And you end up getting a few crumbs here and there. Do you think this is enough to keep those guys fat and happy? Or are they just going to come back to the table demanding more after this?
So to put it up front, I'm not a social conservative. So most of my knowledge on these issues is as kind of an outsider conservative on this. But what I've seen written is that this is a really horrible idea. You're right in what the executive order says is that the IRS, it gives the IRS the discretion not to enforce the Johnson Amendment, which says that churches cannot engage in political activities without risking their nonprofit status. So it's just an option. It's saying to the IRS, you can do this, or you don't actually have to enforce this.
So the IRS commissioner really... could simply ignore the order and go forth and prosecute anyway.
Although... Yes, exactly. And what's worse is, technically, the IRS commissioner, and this would be horrendous, but it is theoretically possible, the IRS commissioner could say, you know, the Episcopalian Church has been advocating for liberal Democrats in the Northeast. I'm going to enforce the Johnson Amendment on them, but I'm not going to enforce it on, you know, Southern Presbyterian churches that are busing people to the poll. Well, that's actually sanctioned activity, that are explicitly advocating from the pulpit right. on behalf of Republican candidates. I think it's a really bad idea. What's weird about this is it's kind of what I've seen it is people who are super cynical on the social conservative side are the only ones who care about this. They're the ones who say what churches should be about, not should be about, what churches should be able to do is engage in political activity solely for the reason that it benefits Republicans, not because it has theological grounding or that it's about the religion itself, but that it's just a turnout mechanism, that they're worried that churches aren't voting in large enough numbers, and if they did, they would vote for more Republicans and more Republicans could win. It's simply like a political ploy. The earnest social conservative, the earnest and honest social conservatives that I've seen writing on this and I've talked to on this, don't think that for most social conservatives, this is a big deal. They don't want to see their preachers politicizing the pulpit. They don't want to go to church and hear about how people need to go for vote for Republicans every week. So I'm kind of confused as to why this is happening, and I think it's a really bad idea because of the negative, potentially huge downside effects of super politicizing the IRS office on these issues.
I mean, Trump was attacking the Johnson Amendment dishonestly, inaccurately, as a deliberate attempt by Lyndon Johnson to punish churches. During the campaign, he did that. He did it in his acceptance address at the convention. He did it in a speech to evangelical leaders around the same time. You know, I remember hearing him doing it, and I'm saying to myself, "This is as wrong as he was about the history of it. A surprising amount of knowledge about a very specific provision in the law for a guy who doesn't really get into the weeds very much." Right. I can only assume someone around him, some social conservative liaison of his, said to him, "This is a good way for you to show that you mean what you say, and they shouldn't treat you as an interloper." So I've also heard, as what you've just said, that a lot of ministers don't really want this, don't want that much a bleeding between politics and church activities. But someone does.
I think it's those cynical leaders, right? So I saw a lot of social conservatives that I respect turn on some of the leaders like Jerry Falwell in this election, and the people who kind of excused Trump's obvious personal moral failings and indiscretions and his clear, like, disinterest in being a religious person. You know, he was someone who during the campaign said he's never felt the need to ask for forgiveness from God for anything that he's ever done because he doesn't think that he needs it. And that's like, and yet in spite of all of these obvious anti-social conservative views that Trump has.
And Christian, that's just a fundamental tenet right. of Christianity, that we're all sinners and need forgiveness.
And in spite of all that, the evangelical leaders all pretty much full-throatedly endorsed him. And that was very disillusioning for a lot of kind of rank-and-file social conservatives that I know who care about social conservative issues in the political realm, but think that those leaders have kind of abandoned the religion part of it and become basically just mechanisms of the Republican Party rather than people who are in it for the faith. So I think it's those types of evangelical leaders, the ones who were ready to endorse Trump basically no matter what kind of person he was during the campaign, that are operating primarily as political instruments, who believe that turning Republicans out to the polls is more important than the actual faith that goes on in the churches.
So for those leaders that you do talk to, who are unnerved by what has happened, I mean, clearly there weren't that many of them who vote, otherwise Trump wouldn't have won. Including keeping social conservatives in the fold was essential for him getting as many votes as he did, even though he got less, he got enough.
Right.
I mean, if those folks stayed home, that wouldn't have happened. So, I mean, how much damage has been done between the intellectual social conservative leaders who say, look, Trump is not on the level here, this violates all sorts of tenets, I now have to question whether even are the rank and file here truly that devout, or they just want to get what's theirs, or is everyone saying, look, and at the end of the day, ends justify the means, or I'm going to get a bunch of policies that I like, I got a Supreme Court justice that I like. Sure,
so,
I'm not my kind of guy, but I'm still coming out ahead out of all this.
So basically what I think the Donald Trump phenomenon has revealed is that there's a massive disconnect from what you just termed kind of the intellectual establishment and leaders and people who are actually registered voters. And that applies to all aspects of the conservative movement. So, Donald Trump had the fewest establishment endorsements of anyone from all sides of the Republican Party. And he still won the nomination. So I think it's those kind of intellectual leaders who dislike Donald Trump and were disappointed in all of the endorsements that he got from social conservatives mean that their influence is actually a lot smaller than they thought it was. And this goes for fiscal conservatives, it goes for foreign policy conservatives, it goes for social conservatives, and that just applies here. The defense that I've seen from a lot of the social conservatives that I talk to is, if you break down the actual evangelical vote by category, that weekly churchgoers voted for Donald Trump in smaller numbers than the widely self-described evangelical community, which means that the evangelical label itself has been watered down to people who don't particularly go to church all that often. So that's a problem, but it might just mean that the evangelicals, the self-described evangelicals who are really serious about their faith and go to church weekly, is a much smaller segment of the population and much less politically powerful segment of the population than we previously believed.
Okay, one more topic before we go, and I'm doing this selfishly because I'm in the midst of writing a piece on 2020 and the Democratic field. Normally I don't like to talk about stuff that I write until it's published so I can selfishly self-promote it. Now I selfishly want some help in writing it, so a conversation would do me good. My early sense is, the scars of 2016 haven't gone away. We saw it play out in the DNC chair race. We're seeing it game played out in the special election races where populist folks and establishment folks are skirmishing about the strategies these candidates should be taking. There's a long history of idealists versus pragmatists in Democratic primaries, whether it was, Clinton Sanders, Obama Clinton, Dean Kerry, Gore Bradley, Clinton Jerry Brown, Dukakis Jesse Jackson. That's a pretty standard fault line. I mean, with varying intensity, but the fault lines are there. And now you have a seemingly ascendant progressive populist wing that makes the extra argument, we're the pragmatic choice too. You need our populist fire to win. It's not just out of moral purity. You're starting to see people angle to present themselves as the leading populist. But are we going to see people present themselves as leading pragmatists, or people present themselves as leading unifiers who can transcend these divisions? So that's sort of my early thinking about where this might go. But as you might have seen some of the articles about, you know, maybe Biden's going to run, or maybe mayors are going to run, maybe Sheryl Sandberg is going to run. Do you have any early thoughts about how you think this is starting to shape up?
I think your breakdown is correct, but I want to know, do you have a power rankings of top five contenders right now? Not even who would be contenders, but who theoretically would be the people who would be the leading populists or the leading fusionists on the side of the Democrats right now?
You know, as big as the field may be, and you have some big names in that field already, you know, one would be tempted to say there's some real heavy hitters here. You know, if Bernie ran again, clearly he has a loyal following. If Elizabeth Warren ran, her following may arguably be bigger than his. If Joe Biden ran again, he comes in with a lot of clout. Now, all those people are old guard in a way. At minimum, they're old. I mean, I don't want to be ageist about it, but there's clearly a sentiment amongst people, some people in the party, that it's time for new leadership. We got a whole bunch of young folks coming up. We can't be putting up the same people over and over again. These people will be older than Donald Trump in the case of Biden and Sanders. You don't want that to be an issue in the campaign. And so then you get to start talking about some of the first-term senators like Kamala Harris or I guess Cory Booker's still first term. Maybe you get into, there's not that many governors out there to choose from. Those, you know, Andrew Cuomo clearly has some interest. He would not be beloved by populist progressives. Same with John Hickenlooper in Colorado, would not be a populist favorite, but certainly has certain fans. Maybe your one great populist gubernatorial choice would be Steve Bullock in Montana, who I don't believe has made a lot of motions of being interested in running, but might pique people's interest. So I don't feel any of them. Already that's very crowded. You know, if Bernie and Warren run, neither one gets automatic claim to the entirety of the populist side of the party. If Joe Biden runs, well, now everyone's foreign policy game needs to go up about five notches because he will cut you. He will destroy you. Maybe Biden can't win. Maybe Biden's got plenty of baggage, you know, high gaffe propensity and the like. But he will find your weakness and he will destroy you on that stage if you don't have your act together. And, you know, I think Bernie was very damaged by his inability to match Hillary Clinton on foreign policy knowledge. There's definitely a faction of pragmatic voters who are older, who want to see that you're ready to be commander in chief. If you're going to be doing a bunch of half-assed talking points, it's not going to fly. So his entry, I think, has to make anyone thinking about running think very hard. How are you going to go toe-to-toe with a guy like that? I'm dancing around your question because I don't have like an easy, you know, three, four, five that I say are giant killers. I do want to keep an eye on people who are not going to be on anyone's list right now because they're not currently in office. And by that, I don't mean the Mark Cubans and Sheryl Sandbergs. I mean people who might win governor's races next year. Here's the dance I think Democrats are trying to have to follow is, on one hand, you don't want someone who's been around for too long, who has a lot of baggage, who doesn't speak like a regular American anymore. Candidates like that, you know, Al Gore, Hillary Clinton, you know, have a tough time. That's Bob Dole, but it's not a Democratic issue. Bob Dole was a similar problem.
Yeah.
Fresh faces have more punch, get more energy. However, they come with less experience. And you're going to be following 4 years of Trump where the standard argument is going to be you tried a total outsider, a total dilettante, someone who claimed it was so easy and found out in a matter of weeks that everything was more complicated than he thought. You're going to want someone who can show they can handle the job on day one. how do you get that without someone who's been around too long and has too much baggage? Maybe a governor who's only been in for a year or so, who might normally be treated as too green, could make the argument, hey, I'm from the real America, but I got in there, I got a quick victory of some sort that I can hang my hat on. I mean, this is the Woodrow Wilson path. Woodrow Wilson in 1909 was president of Princeton University. He just got his hat handed to him by the Board of Trustees because he couldn't reform the eating clubs. He thought, I've lost my power base. I'm a leader with no following at Princeton. What am I going to do with myself? The Democratic machine of New Jersey reaches out to him to run for governor, thinking he could front for them in a progressive time and withstand the progressive tide and keep the machine politicians in power. He wins. He backstabs the machine politicians when he denies Sugar Jim, the main Democrat, a Senate seat. That gives him a huge fan base nationally as a true blue progressive, which he used to ride into the Democratic nomination in 1912 and becomes president in that year. You know, two plus years removed of not even being in politics. So could someone follow that path, get that quick win as governor, get a quick win as governor, and then be the fresh face in 2020? I'm curious if we can pull off that that high wire act.
That would definitely be interesting, and I'm not deep in enough into Democratic politics to know like which gubernatorial seats, which Senate seats might be something where a fresh face could win. You did mention, I think, the guy who could be the best fusionist option to beat, to both win the Democratic primary and beat Donald Trump, and that's Cory Booker, who I think would have a lot of problems on the progressive side of things.
Yeah.
Labor unions, not necessarily the biggest fan, ties to Wall Street.
Charter schools?
Charter schools, labor unions.
Right.
So I think that he would probably have more problems winning the nomination. But Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 based on two mistakes in her turnout estimates, and that was more people who voted for Obama in 2012, more working class white people in the Midwest who voted for Obama in 2012 flipped to Donald Trump in 2016 than they expected, and Donald Trump won both a larger share of the minority vote than they were expecting, and the minority vote did not vote in large enough numbers to overcome Clinton's problems with Donald Trump. So someone who can speak to that community, I think, would be a plus on the Democratic side. And that's not to say Cory Booker is the only person, but I think that he's a good candidate for that. The other that I don't think you've mentioned, and I have no idea if he's even interested in running, is Sherrod Brown, who I think has a lot of the progressive bona fides, is from the Midwest, kind of doesn't have that, like you said, typical politician speak, I don't think. He doesn't sound like a politician. He sounds more like a regular guy. He's a little more established. He wouldn't be a green face, but he can say, I've been in Congress for X number of years now. I know how Washington works. So he bridges the divide between the people who want a progressive and someone who might want someone who knows how Washington works to beat Donald Trump. His only downside is that, and he's a very nice person, I've heard, I've never met him, but I know people who have, he sounds like a James Bond villain. His voice is just, he sounds like he's going to torture a secret agent just because of the gruffness of his voice. But that could be a benefit when it comes to the, like, doesn't speak like a politician.
I mean, everything we've so about aesthetics has been upended. You know, no one thought the way Trump carried
right,
his up
exactly.
with a stump would work. No one thought the way Bernie Sanders' stump was going to play, you know, grumpy yep. old man. People thought no one would vote for Barack Hussein Obama. That wasn't true. So those sorts of stylistic critiques, I mean, to the extent they have, they present obstacles, they're usually obstacles you can overcome with you can make those disadvantages turn into advantages.
And certainly against Donald Trump, who's not like a conventional politician by any means, even if you're being unconventional in your style, it's not like that's a downside compared to the other guy who's even more unconventional probably than any Democrat that's going to run.
But you raise two important demographic points. One is Obama won in part because he really juiced non-white turnout. Hillary did basically as well as an average Democrat does with non-white turnout, which is really good. Just Obama was exceptional. And Hillary tried to compensate for that by leaning in very hard on Black Lives Matter, on gun control, on immigration. These are issues where Obama was more delicate about. And Hillary, lost both ways. She sparked a rural white backlash, and she didn't replicate the non-white turnout, in part because Trump, arguing with the system, what happened in the primary, were pushing, hey, you were involved in the crime bill in the 90s, and you're part of the mass incarceration trend, and all that sort of thing. So she couldn't regain that level of credibility. So a Cory Booker or Kamala Harris, or maybe there's an African American woman running for governor of Georgia. If she wins the nomination and she and actually pulled off a red state upset, she would get a whole lot of national attention.
Oh, yeah.
That would raise eyebrows. But Obama in the 2008 primary owned that space. Probably no one's going to own any space, because you're probably
Right.
going to have multiple non-white candidates. You're going to have multiple progressive populists. You might have multiple Midwest or Interior West candidates. If not, there could be Sherrod Brown, could have Al Franken, could have Amy Klobuchar. You could have, if not the governor of Montana, Steve Ballot, maybe the last governor, Brian Schweitzer, could throw his hat in the ring. There are a lot
Schweitzer was a rumored candidate for like 10 years, I
of
feel like.
right. And he hasn't gotten on TV a lot these days, but he wants to get back on TV. Who knows?
Right.
So it's so wide open, it's hard to see a small, compact field. And so there's going to be a lot of jostling to try to claim these mantles and argue that owning that mantle is the key to 2020, when the truth is you need to have a lot of mantles to put together the kind of coalition that you need.
And I think, the DNC and Hillary Clinton kind of took the Obama coalition for granted that, the demographic argument was so powerful that, that the Democrats were never going to lose kind of that advantage that they had. So I think that they took that for granted, and they need to re-examine that. And I honestly think the long-term demographic advantage that the Democratic Party has is still going to be is going to loom large over electoral politics, but in the short term, it is something that Democrats need to reckon with. That they thought that the demographics of the general election vote in presidential elections were so favorable that they didn't really need to worry about them, and 2016 upended that.
Yeah, I want to push back slightly, since we can never stop debating, what Hillary did in 2016. Because what I was saying about Black Lives Matter and guns, I don't feel that argues they took it for granted. I think they knew they had a white working class problem, and they knew they needed to replicate what Obama did in terms of non-white votes. And they knew they had to do something. They had to actually take a position. And I don't want to say that that position was wholly insincere and nothing but political calculation. But it was a choice to emphasize it. I think they understood that an action needed to be taken to replicate that. They thought that coalition was the coalition to replicate. And they had to take certain acts to replicate it, that it wasn't just going to fall into their laps. Now, what they missed, which I think is different than taking for granted. I don't think they assumed they had a certain amount of, white working class votes in hand. I think they knew that most of these voters were already Republicans. I mean, Democrats never won white working class in recent memory. It's a question of proportion. They took for granted, if you want to use that phrase, that the turnout levels would be roughly similar in that demographic than the last few elections. They were not anticipating the surge. It's hard for anyone to predict a surge. You can't poll that easily. So I think they missed it. It was a mistake, but a somewhat hard mistake to avoid. I mean, if your presumption is that she needed to be more economically populist to get those votes. Well, she flipped on TPP.
Right.
She had plenty of things to say about Wall Street regulations. Like, she didn't avoid those subjects. Their argument was just not a lot she was going to do based on her long history to get those votes, which then raises the question, was Bernie a better choice? And you could make that argument, but then you have to then at least grapple with, would a white working class voter in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Florida, would they have preferred a non-bigoted economic populist over a bigoted economic populist?
Right.
And I don't think you can necessarily assume that.
Yeah, that's acting as though the kind of long tail hard left downsides of Bernie Sanders are also not an impediment to voting for him for those voters that you do want to win. Like, he comes with upside. He would have come with upside advantage over Hillary Clinton, but he would also have come with some downsides.
And I think this is important. This is helping me for my piece. Because when Bernie ran against Hillary had to be very careful how she approached him. I mean, she had her jabs, of course, but she wasn't going to go too hard on him as someone who was too left, because she didn't want to alienate those voters later on.
Right.
You know, she didn't play, you know, a Castro card very hard on Bernie.
Right.
She hit him more as someone who maybe was going to be pragmatic enough, you know, couldn't get the things that she could get done. Try to go to his left on things like guns. There's definitely a portion of the party who have animus towards Bernie now. You know, they may not be as loud about it as the pro-Bernie side, but it exists. And
right.
You saw it with the Heath Mellow controversy, where Narol came out, you know, guns a-blazing, criticizing Bernie for endorsing Heath Mellow. I don't think Bernie is going would face a rougher primary in 2020 than he did in 2016. As much as they complain they got unfair treatment, they haven't seen nothing, I think.
Right.
It's going to be a much more wild and woolly primary, and the kind of jiu-jitsu moves that Bernie likes to make. Hey, you know, if you want to have an economic populist party, you need to downplay things here and there so we can build out the widest base, which is an argument you can make, but you're going to get popped for that in a Democratic primary. Things like abortion I don't know if he's going to do it on guns, but right now you have Rob Quist caressing his rifle in ads. James Thompson in Kansas are brandishing his rifle too. Those issues are going to come up again. And Bernie seems a little bit more eager to say, if you want an economic populist party, we got to reach those voters. And those premises will be put under scrutiny in a primary. And when that is mostly Democratic voters who don't think that way.
Yeah, I think that's right. I will be super interested. Again, like, I'm not familiar with the lower profile Democrats, but I will be super interested even in who throws their hat into the ring, because, you know, the 2016 election showed, to me at least, that the non-Clinton Democratic bench was very, very weak. I think that with 4 years of marinating, there will be stronger candidates out there. So I'm not sure if we're going to see like a – was it 2012 we had like 16 Republican candidates, and 2016 we had 18 Republican candidates. If the stage is going to be that big on the Democratic side, I mean, 2016 was when they segregated. They had the top tier debates and then the like second tier candidate debates. So I don't know if we're going to see the, you know, George Pataki's of the Democratic side come out of the woodwork and poll at 2% for 4 months before dropping out. But I'll be super interested just to see who gets in, you know?
Absolutely. Well, why don't we call it here? Remind folks, Kevin Glass, where can people find your work?
I'm a contributor to the Washington Examiner. You can click on the Rational Actors tab on the side of the page, depending on what side of this I'm on. Check out that podcast and my work at the Examiner.
And I'm Bill Scherr. You can catch me at Politico, as well as Real Clear Politics. And hopefully next week we'll get Matt Lewis back here, but always great to have you on. Kevin, hope we can have you back in the future.
Sure thing. Have fun, Matt.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.